This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
On TSN1290.ca.
Sherratt stepped into Sundquist. Bufflin back into his own zone. Tried to clear, could not. Shin to the front of the net. Score!
After video review, the call on the ice stands.
For Schwartz, and he didn't get much on it. Bozak back for Schwartz. Scores! And the St. Louis Blues capitalize on the power play and have a 2-0 lead. Around the boards, Ryan O'Reilly ahead of goals for Jaden Schwartz. Two in the game. Schwartz in on goal, scores! And it is raining hats here in St. Louis.
And with a whimper, not a bang, the Winnipeg Jets season ended in St. Louis on Saturday night. They dropped the game 3-2. They dropped the series 4-2. The St. Louis Blues on to the second round. The Winnipeg Jets gone home, gone golfing for the summer. Good evening, Winnipeg. Good evening, Manitoba. And for all those joining us live this evening at TSN1290.ca and via the iHeartRadio app, we say good evening, universe, and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Alongside Sean Assor and Ezra Ginsberg, I'm your host, Drew Mandel. We have 2 hours of hockey talk for you on this Wednesday evening. We're going to look back, of course, at the Winnipeg Jets' defeat at the hands of the St. Louis Blues. We'll talk about the exit day interviews that occurred earlier this week. We're all over the Stanley Cup playoffs and the game 7 between the Washington Capitals and the Carolina Hurricanes. Capitals lead 2-0 halfway through the first period in Washington. We're all over everything. We want to hear from you. You can reach us here in studio via Twitter. Send your tweets to @IllegalCurve. We're also available via text message. Send your text to 129090. Standard messaging rates do apply. We go back, of course, to Saturday night in St. Louis. The Jets down 3-2 in the series at the start of the game. They're looking for a good push. They're looking for a good response. After the disappointment of Game 5, they don't get that. They end up being down 3-0 to the Blues, mustering all of 6 shots on goal through 40 minutes. And as I said, with a whimper, not a bang, they lose the series to the Blues. Ezzy, good evening. Nice to see you. Your thoughts
on... Nice to see you, too.
Yes, thank you. Your thoughts...
And Sean as well.
And Sean as well. Sean, of course.
Good to see both of you.
Yeah, you're the handsome one of the three of us here, Sean.
I try.
But, yeah, I know. With the Jets' performance on Saturday night, the score flatters them in that it's a one-goal game. But when you're facing elimination and you can muster all of 6 shots on goal in 40 minutes, that's a pretty damning statement regarding your readiness and your performance in a do-or-die situation.
Yeah, you know, the Jets just didn't muster up enough offense. Drew, you mentioned the amount of shots that the Jets had after 2 periods, and I think we would all agree here, boys in studio, that, you know, the Jets only really turned it on in the 3rd period when the game was over. And you know, there were some unfortunate penalties. You think of, you know, the Jacob Trouba high sticking penalty, the Buff roughing penalty on David Perron, and obviously, you know, the double minor towards the end of the game. Blake Wheeler, you know, when the Jets are pushing to tie this game and force a game 7, I mean, the Jets just weren't disciplined. But it really comes down to, guys, the Jets just really didn't show up in game 6. I mean, they just weren't good enough. And, you know, we talk about the penalties and the lack of shots, but in a game like that, coming off of just that demoralizing Game 5 loss, I think, you know, we talked about it on the Saturday show. I mean, it was just such a horrible way to lose with 15 seconds left. But, you know, it, first off, it's just weird to get up and, you know, prepare for the show tonight and not have the Jets playing. It feels like, you know, it's been 2 weeks since they were eliminated. It's mm-hmm. It's only been 4 days. But, you know, you mentioned that we've already had the end of season interviews on Monday, and we'll get into that a little bit later. But, you know, just the way this series ended, it was really anticlimactic, I thought. And kind of similar to, you know, the way the Bruins-Leafs series ended, guys, with Game 7. You know, obviously, you know, the 5-1 score, you know, included some empty net goals. But I just thought that in a series in which the majority of the games were decided by a goal, I just thought that just the effort that was put out there by the Jets, the way that this series ended, I don't think really did it justice. Because we talked about, you know, this series, after the series was tied at 2, mm-hmm. after Game 4 in St. Louis, we talked about it. The Jets could have easily been up 3-1 in the series. And, you know, we can go back to Game 2, and, you know, Connor Hellebuyck didn't have a very good game. And you're obviously not going to blame Hellebuyck for the Jets losing this series. But whether you want to point to, you know, the terrible beatdown, you know, that they suffered in Game 5, beat down more so in the sense that the Blues demoralizing loss.
Yeah.
I mean, it really came down to, you know, the Jets' top players didn't really show up in the most important game. We talked about it in a game in which you're facing elimination.
Yeah.
I mean, you needed more from the Connor Scheifele Wheeler line, and you just didn't get it. And, you know, we talked about the Ryan O'Reilly line all series long, and, you know, sure, in games 3 and 4 in St. Louis, Connor Scheifele Wheeler really stepped up. And I thought, even though Patrick Laine entered the playoffs, and there was all types of criticism being heaped on Laine with the way he finished, and the fact that, you know, he didn't have a very good February or, you know, end to the season, month of March, month of April, but, you know, it really wasn't just one player. You really point to the Jets, and they just didn't get that secondary offense. They didn't get the goaltending, and at times the special teams let them down. And,
you know, I said to somebody after Game 5, Sean, I said to somebody after Game 5 when the Jets lost in the manner in which they lost them, and they, you know, an epic collapse that I don't think we're going to forget around these parts for a long time, in the manner in, you know, giving up the game-winning goal with 15 seconds to go. I said to somebody, a team can come back from that kind of loss only if they are rock solid granite in the dressing room. And I said to that person, you know, I don't think that this team is rock solid granite in the dressing room. And then in the manner in which they played game 6, I think I'm validated by that. They were not ready to play game 6. And that is it's not that they're not skilled. It's not that they don't know what to do. They just weren't able to do it. And I don't think it's anything that the Blues necessarily did. The Jets were not ready to play game 6 in St. Louis. And that is a damning statement towards the team, the players, the organization, really top to bottom. It was ultimately a bad season, in that they didn't get out of the first round of the playoffs, and the manner in which they lost game 6 is sort of the cherry on top of it all.
Well, first of all, anytime I get to watch playoff hockey during a Seder is a plus.
Yeah.
Allowed by my folks. It was my parents' idea to have it on. So that was a unique experience for me to begin with. But yeah, you talk about just back to the game. I mean, like, the first goal, Byfuglien backs into Hellebuyck and they challenge. And, you know, you kind of have to challenge because it's a way to grab momentum back. But I mean, when you look at the goal, you think to yourself, it's kind of early to lose the timeout if the challenge goes the other way, and then it does, and then goal 2 gets scored, and Pat Maroon, whether you want to see it or not, he's holding Connor Hellebuck's glove up, whether or not Hellebuck's, you know, not doing his best to avoid that contact is another story, but he was holding the glove up, and then you're unable to challenge. So all of a sudden, that first goal coming back to haunt you for a second time, and you're down 2-0, and
challenging after that first goal to me is a sign of
kind of desperation.
Yeah,
almost
a little bit of panic.
You're clinging, you're looking for some for a quote unquote good bounce. You're looking for, you know, for some,
you're
for
looking
some
to,
luck.
You're looking to make some. Yeah, you're looking to make some luck where none really exists, and that's a sign that I think Paul Maurice deep down probably knew that his room and his bench wasn't right for that game, and so that, you know, you go down early 1-0, you're looking to maybe, you know, get a life preserver of having that goal be disallowed. To me, it's just it's a desperation play by the head coach in that instance, knowing that things aren't going to go well if this goal is allowed, Ezzy.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, I think Maurice would tell you that it was probably a bad challenge. And I think when we were watching that game, we probably didn't expect him to challenge. But, you know, it goes back to kind of what we were talking about before. The Jets were never leading this series. And you almost think that they put everything into games 3 and 4 so that they could bring the series back to Winnipeg tied. Mm-hmm. Because you knew if the Jets were down 3-1 to the Blues, the way they had been playing in the second half of the season, the way Jordan Binnington had been playing, I mean, we knew that he wasn't going to have, you know, 3 or 4 bad games in this series. And Binnington overall did outplay Hellebuyck, but, you know, I actually think Hellebuyck was pretty good in this series. Now,
I'm not laying the blame on the shoulders of Connor Hellebuyck for
it was one bad,
yeah,
really
one
bad
game.
One game that really stands out, and we know what game that was. That was game 2.
Yeah, and Binnington had one bad game as well. I mean, you know, Binnington's game 3 wasn't anything to write home about. So each goalie sort of had a bad game, and, you know, other than that, the goaltending I thought was relatively even. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, the Jets, you know, simply after game 5, or even, you know, they just panicked. They looked panicky. And then by the time game 6 rolled around, you know, you get 6 shots on goal through 40 minutes. That's a sign you don't really want to be there. It's a sign you're not really that keen on keeping the season going, because there's no excuse for that. I mean, in this day and age in the NHL, you know, 6 shots is hard to put up. To put up that few shots, you have to try to be that inept offensively.
Right, and I agree with that. And, you know, at the end of the day, I don't think the Jets lost this series because they played poor defensively. I mean, we talked about it. Nikolai Ehlers, 0 points in the series. Right? Jack Roslovic. Yes, sure. You know, Ehlers had the, you know, he left the game with a concussion and all that.
And he played game six with a fractured leg. Well,
but the point is, I mean, Nikolai Ehlers is
a part
of your primary offense. He's not a guy that you would say, oh, hopefully he chips in some secondary offense.
He's now played, 20 playoff games without a goal?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's hard going back to last year as well.
Right. And I'm not putting on Nikolai Ehlers, but, you know, Jack Roslovic was not a factor offensively. Kevin Hayes, I thought, had
24 games,
two or three good games of the series. But, you know, Kevin Hayes finishes the series on the fourth line, whereas when he was acquired by the Jets, he was the second line center. You know, you look at Brandon Tanev, he had the goal in, was it game three? He had the goal. And then really, he wasn't a factor offensively for much of the series. Yes, he was dealing with an injury. But the point is, guys, I mean, when Connor Scheifele Wheeler wasn't clicking and then you weren't getting, you know, the second line offense from Brian Little and Patrick Laine, they just didn't score enough goals. What did they average? 2.5 goals a game or less than 2.5 goals a game in this series. So, I mean, you just didn't have enough guys clicking offensively. It's not like, you know, the St. Louis Blues completely blew the Jets out of the water offensively. I mean, we talked about it. These were one goal games. You're talking about if you're able to get a goal out of a guy like, you know, Jack Roslovic or, you know, Matty Perreault didn't have any goals in this series. Yeah. And again, you know, I'm not singling out three or four players. I'm just saying when you look back at this series, there aren't too many players that stand out as having great series, right? Buff, I think, was the Jets' best player in the playoffs,
and he tailed off certainly in the last couple games of the series.
And Kyle Connor, you know, I mean, and obviously those guys, you know, were first and second on the Jets in points. But the point is, how many guys did Paul Maurice have at his disposal, to throw over the bench, and you know, when they needed a key goal,
and they
just didn't have that many guys that were. Well, clicking at that high level, and that was kind of the issue going into the playoffs was, you know, the last, let's say, 15 to 20 games,
but the Jets,
you know, the Jets were a .500 hockey team.
In Game 5, the Jets score 12 seconds into the game, and St. Louis has a great response. And they end up winning the game after, you know, they, you know, controlled the majority of Game 5. And then the Jets, when they have an opportunity to make a statement about themselves in Game 6, they muster up those 6 shots on goal in the first 40 minutes. And everything else that happened in that game, and I know it ends up being a 3-2 game, and I know the Jets, you know, have a good third period to make it close. But the number 6, only getting 6 shots on goal, 1 shot in the second period where your season is on the line and you're desperate, to me is just a damning statement. I know I've said that a few times in this segment.
It's interesting because we've been talking about the shots pretty much since January with this team, the lack of shots, and you know, when they needed it the most, we saw it in its most extreme form.
And it's not just the shots, it's what the shots represent.
Sure.
It's the effort level.
Agreed.
It's the give an F factor, right?
I mean, yeah, it's not 11, it's 6.
Right, and this is a team that went to the West Final last year, Shawnee, and they wanted to go to the Stanley Cup Final. They weren't going to be happy with going to the second or third round, so it's what those shots represent. It's the fact that the Jets were playing for their lives. I mean, elimination was on the line. They needed to force that Game 7, bring it back to Bell MTS Place, and, you know, they just didn't have it. Yes, there were guys dealing with injuries. Brandon Tanev, you know, Josh Morrissey, Nikolai Ehlers, all these guys are dealing with injuries, but give me one team that was in the playoffs this year that didn't have 2, 3, 4 guys dealing with injuries.
Everybody has injuries. Everybody's exhausted after playing. I mean, you don't think the St. Louis Blues were tired? They had to come back from being the dead last team in the NHL at the beginning of 2019 to get to this point. That takes a lot of effort. It takes a lot of energy to get to that point. I mean, we'd been talking about the Jets dressing room. Was the dressing room right for, you know, a month or 6 weeks? And then when you know that the spotlight is going to be shining its brightest on you on a Saturday night, Game 6, elimination game, the only game that's on, you know, that night on television, you put up six shots on goal through 40 minutes. That tells you that the room's not right. That tells you that there was trouble afoot for this team, and it, you know, manifested itself in that Game 6 effort by the Jets.
And by the way, the Jets averaged 2.67 goals a game in the series, the exact same as the Blues. I mean, we talked about it. I mean, the Jets had the slight advantage, Shawnee, when it came to, you know, scoring attempts and inner slot shots. You know, we've talked about that all year with, you know, Mike Kelly and Sean Tierney. You mentioned, you know, the Jets had that issue. They were giving up too many high quality scoring chances. And in this series, that it really wasn't that. I mean, it was so even that each game came down to one goal. I mean, Kyle Connor, we saw him get the overtime winner, in Game 4. It just basically came, and to me, the reason why that stands out is because during the regular season, the Jets were a top offensive team. I mean, 2.67 goals a game is just, I mean, that's just an average offensive team, and the Jets aren't an average offensive team. So when I look back at this series, that's what it's going to come down to. It's going to come down to, you know, the Jets just weren't able to muster up enough offense when they needed it.
When we come back, we talk about the exit day interviews. We talk about some of the comments from the players and the coaching staff of the Winnipeg Jets. You're listening to NHL This Week. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
On TSN 1290.ca.
I'm disappointed as hell, you know, and it just bothers you so much because you all know the time that we all put into this. And I know you do too because you're here most of the time, but you understand that the commitment that you make, it's you put your soul into it, and then you lose, man. Like, it feels so bad, but we got good men here, and yeah, we're gonna lose some good men probably to make everything fit, and we've got a few ruffled feathers in there. We're gonna have to flatten out here before we get going, and that's a good thing. And then we'll get back at her, and this franchise is getting stronger.
That's Jets head coach Paul Maurice Monday in the end of season interviews. Lots of Jets players spoke. Some other Jets players didn't. Notably, Dustin Byfuglien wasn't one of the Jets players who met with the media, which is a bit curious from a guy who wears the assistant captaincy on his jersey. But, you know, obviously that's Byfuglien's prerogative, for better or worse. Welcome back to NHL This Week. Drew Mandel, Sean Assor, Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio. This segment of the show brought to you by Dr. Les Rikus and the team at Linden Market Dental Center. Dr. Rikus and his team provide modern and comprehensive dental care for the whole family. To make an appointment today, visit LindenMarketDentalCenter.com.
Boys, am I the only one that doesn't care that Buff didn't speak? Like, he didn't speak to the media. Who cares?
I don't think he owes the media anything, because I think that he should speak because if he's wearing the assistant captain letter on
he's part of the captaincy group.
Yeah, if he's on the leadership group, he should speak. He doesn't have to say anything. He doesn't have to be insightful at all. I don't really care if he stands there and say, as long as we stick together, we'll be all right, as he did in the playoffs against the Ducks, however many years ago. But to not be there to at least answer a couple questions is a little sour in my mouth.
I mean, that's just me personally. Like, I just don't, like you said, if he speaks to the media, but he just speaks in cliches and doesn't say anything, well, then what's the point?
Well, it doesn't matter that it's that Dustin Byfuglien, the person, isn't there speaking. It's, in my opinion, it's part of a leadership group that needs to be there at the end of the season.
Okay,
that's just my personal opinion.
Right, Shawnee, and fair enough, but my whole point is, like, how many guys came out? There were, like, 14 Jets that came out, right? Or 15 Jets or something.
But
there's too many. Like, why do I need to hear from half of the team?
Well,
three quarters of the team? Like, as far as I'm concerned, I want to hear from Chevy. I want to hear from Paul Maurice. I want to hear from, you know, Wheeler, Scheifele, maybe a few guys.
I want to hear from Wheeler and Scheifele because one's the captain, one's the assistant captain. I want to hear from Dustin Byfuglien because he's the assistant captain. I want to hear from Maurice because he's the coach. And
there are some other guys, you know, the good speakers, the Andrew Copps, the Adam Lowrys, they give you their, you
but
know,
how
the
many
truth
guys do we need to hear? Well, as far as I'm concerned, I just, you know, it was such a big deal was made out of Dustin Byfuglien not speaking. I'm just saying, like, whatever reason he had for not speaking, just, like, does it really matter? Does that change what happened?
No.
Like, was he going to say anything that was going to change anything?
Probably not, because nobody usually says anything of any interest unless
and that's my point.
Unless you're the Golden Knights San Jose Sharks series, right. Which there was a lot of interesting comments in that one.
Jonathan Marchessault was not happy, and why would he be?
And we'll play that later on in the show when we get to that. But, you know, Paul Maurice talks
at least
about
tied the game up, eh, Sean? Yeah.
Paul Maurice talks about ruffled feathers, which goes, I think, again to the idea that the Jets dressing room wasn't as cohesive as you would want it to be. I mean, it seems evident at this point that nobody knows specifics as to this individual was unhappy or this, you know, this was the issue between individual Y and individual Z. But for whatever, you know, it seems like the Jets do need a little bit of, you know, TLC to go on. I don't mean Tanev Lowry and Kopp, but a little tender loving care in that dressing room to get everybody back on the same page ahead of next season.
Distance, maybe get away from each other. You know, turn the phones off.
Absence makes the heart grow fonder, as they do say.
Group chat and.
Maybe a little yoga retreat.
A little namaste. A little namaste between one another. Yeah. Whatever it might be. I mean, I thought the Jets, I think it was just carried over from game six. Obviously, game six was not how they wanted to go out. The scrums at the end of game six were not overly reflective well on the team. I don't think that the media day was overly reflective well. I mean, Mark Scheifele just looked, you know, there was an old politics trick that I learned is to, when you watch a press conference, or you listen to a press conference, press mute. So don't actually hear what they're saying, but just watch the body language. Watch how they're presenting themselves. And I thought the manner in which Mark Scheifele presented
itself. But isn't the whole point of a press conference that you want to hear what they're saying?
No, because oftentimes if they speak in cliche, if they say nothing of interest, press mute and just watch the body language.
Well, if you're going to do that, why not just not watch it at all?
Because the body language and the
more telling than the
attitude and what they're... And
what is this, a psychology course?
Yeah, a little bit. I'm telling you. The way they're presenting themselves says as much maybe as the words do. And Mark Scheifele, and I tweeted this out yesterday or 2 days ago. I thought Mark... it was on Monday. I thought Mark Scheifele's body language, when he sat up there next to Blake Wheeler, to me, was terrible.
But what is he supposed to be excited?
No.
Our season just ended. I'm going to have a big smile on my face.
He's supposed to be a
He's supposed to stand up there and he's supposed to you know, look professional.
You're Jacob right. Trouba didn't look that happy.
Well, does he ever look happy talking to the media?
I mean, there were a bunch of...
Not happy, as in he should... Not happy-go-lucky, not smiley, not, you know, excited that the season's over, but the way that you're supposed to present yourself. Don't come in all sullen and... grumpy and closed off and shoulders and you know with your hat pulled down over your eyes.
You know, the first thing
that doesn't bother me.
Question for both of you. They ask Wheeler, they ask Scheifele. He just goes, "Yeah, I agree with everything he says."
Exactly.
I mean, you know, just give a 30-second answer. Give a little bit of insight. You wear the A. That's a responsibility of an associate captain.
But it goes back to what I said. I guess, you know, this is just my own personal opinion, boys, but I just think too much is put into these end-of-season player interviews. Like, if you lose a series in the first round and you lose in six games, I mean, these guys – and it was what, 2 days after they lost, right? It was Monday.
Yeah.
So, I mean, these guys are – their season's over. I mean, it's golf time for the Jets.
Right.
You know, it's time for them to go on their vacations or just – the season's over. So they're not happy to begin with. And they also have their team meetings, right? So, you know, we don't know exactly how long those go, but they're around the arena for, let's say, 2 or 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's time to talk to the media. This is just me. And I'm someone, I guess, that's in the media. And I just don't really care. I don't need to hear from 15 players.
And then,
you know, we're talking about their body language. And, you know, Jacob, a lot of people were getting on Jacob Trouba because he didn't really give an answer on whether or not he wanted to be back next year. I mean,
Jacob Trouba gave the exact...
What's he going to say?
No, Jacob Trouba gave the exact answer I expected from Jacob Trouba. I don't...
Well, that's what I'm saying. Why even ask it?
Well, the only one that I would be... I'm not concerned, because concerned isn't the right word. The only one that caused me to sort of pay more attention was Mark Scheifele. Just because the way he presented himself is so different.
But he wears his heart on his sleeve.
I know.
I mean, he's not going to be a guy that you're going to expect to give the most articulate answer. I'm not saying that in a you know, negative way on him. I'm saying after you lose game six in that fashion, you know, less than 48 hours later, I mean, you're expecting him to go up there and, you know, give you some substantive answers. I think it's realistic.
Not substantive. I don't even care if it's just cliches, just the manner in which he presented himself. I think if Mark Scheifele looked back at that video and saw himself, he would probably say, that's not the way I want to be portrayed. That's not the way I want to be seen. Even if he says...
Do most Jets fans even care about that? I think most Jets fans care if the team wins. I don't think they really care about how Scheif is in the, you know, postseason interviews. I think they would rather the Jets win game six, win game seven, and go to the second round. That's all I'm saying.
Of course
they would
rather
that. By the way, I'm not disagreeing with you, Drew. You're absolutely right. I mean, Scheifele looked downtrodden. He looked like a guy that did not want to be there. I guess the way I look at it is, if I was him, I wouldn't want to be there either.
Yeah, but, I mean, I would say compare and contrast how he handled... you know, end of season interviews last year when they lost in the Western Conference Final versus this year. And they're both disappointing losses. In one series, you're a series away from getting to the Stanley Cup Final. And it looked like a guy who obviously had just things were different and things didn't necessarily look good on him. And
Fair enough.
I would say there was from my perspective that I took notice of is how he presented himself in that situation.
No, and I'm not going to disagree, and I think that's why there have been a lot of questions about the leadership group on this team. You're talking about Scheifele, you're talking about Wheeler, Buff, Brian Little. I mean, you know, Connor Hellebuck is now a leader of this team. Josh Morrissey, I mean, a lot of people have Morrissey pegged as, you know, the future captain of this team once Blake Wheeler's, you know, career is over. Obviously, it's not going to be over for another 5 or 6 years, but the point is, you know, a lot of questions have been asked about that dressing room, and you know, the way those guys acted definitely only reinforced that.
We'll have much more on the Winnipeg Jets coming up on Saturday show. We're going to do a deep dive into the entire season as a whole. Last word on this segment goes to Paul Maurice. Sean, you have that the clip queued up. Here's Paul Maurice on sort of the end of this season versus the end of last year.
So the difference in our last block of schedule from this year last year was Buffalo and Morrissey out of their lineup three times on the East Coast, three times on the West Coast. So it's not an excuse. It's a factor if we're relating those two ends of seasons, right? We played, won 10 of our last 11 games. I think we hit 9 non-playoff teams in that run. So that's the different structure. I liked big pieces of our game since March on better than any point of our time prior to that, even though we're not winning the games. The game in Boston's is a right game. Our game in Washington that we lost is one of the best games that we played all year. So there's you lose, so everything feels wrong, but it's not the case. I liked how we entered. Having Josh out and having Dustin out affected that greatly. But we hit then 10 of 13 playoff teams in March, and we're dragging our butts from one end of the country to the other, and we were still competing and grinding, and there's lots of confidence on my part that our game was going to be timed right if we could get her going, if we could get a little healthy, a little fresh in the playoffs. It's a loss, and I'm not trying to sugarcoat it, but I don't feel that way about our season. We lost in the first round. That's under what we'd really expected that we would be able to do. But we played a hell of a series against a good team that played a little bit better than we did.
This is the O'Legal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
25 minutes before the top of the hour. Welcome back to NHL This Week. Drew Mindell, Sean Assor, Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio. This segment of the show brought to you by Frank and Mauro Zappia of Zappia Group Realty, official realtors of O'Legal Curve Hockey. When 95% of your clients come via referral, it shows your commitment to honesty, integrity, and a total dedication to client satisfaction. For all your real estate needs, come shake hands with Frank and Mauro Zappia online at zappiagroup.com.
Now, let's go live on the Legal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
From theathletic.com, Sean Shapiro joins us. Sean covers the Dallas Stars. The Stars off to the second round against the St. Louis Blues. Sean, appreciate your time this evening. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. I'm just sitting here at the airport watching the game 7, so perfect timing.
Yeah, that works out quite well. On your way to St. Louis, of course, for that second round matchup that I got to say, for a while there, not anyone, especially right around, say, Christmas, where, Jim Leitz came out and had his controversial comments about Jamie Benn and Tyler Seguin, and the St. Louis Blues were one of the bottom feeders in the NHL. I don't think anybody at that point in time would have said, yeah, we're going to be in for the Dallas Stars, St. Louis Blues second round playoff series after the Stars knocked off the Predators, 4-2. Yeah, and Sean, from my perspective, keeping a pretty close eye on that series, it wasn't even that close. I mean, the Dallas Stars were far and away the better of the two teams, in my opinion, than the Nashville Predators were in that series.
Yeah, there was one period that was to start the series. Nashville was the better team in period one of game one, and then from then on, Dallas was a 6-game series. But really, Dallas should have won that series in 5. Pekka Rinne stole game 3, and Ben Bishop had his one oopsie moment of the entire series, and Pekka Rinne stole game 3. So Stars should have won that in 5. They were the better team in 5 of the 6 games overall. And it was especially from game 3 on. Even though it was 2-2 going to Nashville for game 5, you felt like Dallas was the better team. It felt like a formality they were going to win. And particularly in game 5, when they just kind of put their foot on everything. And I don't know if you guys probably saw the play where Jamie Benn basically little brothers Ryan Ellis instead of Bradulov for a goal. That's the moment where you're like, okay, we're just waiting for them to close this out, because that for me was Dallas was going to win this series, and they were the better team. I mean, give them full credit for that, and with the exception of really a couple of periods, they did everything they needed to do, and Nashville did not look like the team that we all thought they might have been.
Sean, you just mentioned Jamie Benn, and, he was excellent in this series, as were Tyler Seguin and Alex Radulov, and you would expect, the Stars' top three players, if they were going to win the series, which they obviously did, you would expect those three to lead them in scoring. But, you know, when you talk about Matt Zuccarello, who had three goals in the series, and Rupe Hintz, who, you know, had a breakout season, just how important was the secondary scoring as kind of being, you know, the what put the Dallas Stars over the top in the series?
Yeah, that second line, which by the end of the series became a really good fit with Jason Dickinson and Rupe Hintz and Matt Zuccarello. That second line, they got their points. But the other thing they did was they took a bit of that pressure off the Ben Sagan-Radulov line to produce every single time they stepped on the ice. And when that group gets taking a little bit of stress off that group, and not that they wanted stress on them, but having less pressure on them, forcing the Predators to have to match up differently, it became a matchup nightmare for the Predators. I think one of the best, most telling things by the end of that series, I could hardly tell what the Predators' lines were supposed to be. It felt like Laviolette was trying everything, throwing stuff against the wall, and just to find what could work against the Stars. They weren't able to. So, really, that second line unlocked that, and then having the third line that they could put against the top, whatever the top line was for Nashville at the time, it just really, that second line just turned the Dallas into a threat that could attack in waves. And you know what? That's one of the reasons that heading into St. Louis, Stars have to feel pretty good about themselves, too.
You know, Sean, when we were setting up this series a few weeks ago, I was talking about to the Ezzie and Drew here about how the Stars' success will really depend on how Miro Heiskanen adapts to the playoff game. I mean, fair to say the learning curve isn't that high, and the guy's just thriving under the playoff pressure right now?
I mean, first career, I'm amazed. I don't know why I get surprised anymore by Miro. The fact that you watch him play 82 games, and now I guess you include watching training camp, and I went to the Traverse City rookie tournament. I may have seen 100 games now of him so far. Who knows? Give or take. The fact anything surprises me, I'm surprised at, just because the only reason I get surprised is because his birth certificate says he's 19. The kid's basically a Finnish hockey playing robot. He stepped into his first playoff game, and he said, "What? This is no big deal." He had a goal and an assist. He has the second most minutes played of any player in the playoffs so far. This was 159 minutes in the first round, and he was throughout the series. Nashville said, "Okay, we're going to go hit this kid. We're going to try and lay the pressure on him," and he just shook it off every single time. We shouldn't have been surprised, but he just continued to prove that he really is this franchise defenseman that more and more people are going to take notice now, especially with the less games going on. So more people are going to watch this kid going forward.
Sean Shapiro is our guest on NHL this week. Sean covers the Dallas Stars for TheAthletic.com. The Stars into the second round to face the St. Louis Blues. And Sean, the Stars had good success in the regular season against the Blues, going 3-1-0 in their four games. You know, do you think that this is a good matchup for the Dallas Stars entering the second round series?
Yeah, I do. I think they played well against St. Louis. The other thing too is their record against St. Louis, they didn't play St. Louis till January either. So it's not like that's a 3-1-0 where they bagged two wins like when the Blues were terrible. So they've got they played the Blues when they were good. Of Jordan Binnington, I think Jordan Binnington was 24-6. Of his six losses, two actually came against Dallas. So it's a team where there's not any aura around the Blues for the Stars. And I also think it's a team where there's probably something a little bit extra motivation there for Ben Bishop coming home. He's from St. Louis. I know he's someone who's always seized the moment, and I'm sure he's looking forward to being able to win in his hometown too.
Sean, you reported earlier today that defenseman Jamie Oleksiak is going to miss game one with a lower body injury. And, you know, we wanted to ask you about Oleksiak because he was traded to the Pittsburgh Penguins earlier this season for, I believe, a conditional fourth round pick. And then he was traded back to the Stars. This was, of course, a guy that was drafted by the Stars in the first round back in 2011, if I'm not mistaken. But, you know, he played four games in the series versus the Predators. I guess the first question is, who's going to replace Oleksiak in the lineup for game one? And how have you thought of his second tour with the Stars? Obviously, you know, the first tour was a little bit inconsistent. I think you would agree with that.
Yeah, and when they made the trade, it was the exact same pick that went back. So it was basically hitting the undo button on the trade for both Pittsburgh and Dallas. Oleksiak is, with him being out, Taylor Fadun is going to come back into the lineup, and Fadun's the one who played game one and two for Dallas. against Nashville, but he was victimized by Austin Watson on the first Predators goal in Game 2, where Rocco Grimaldi was in front of the net and Watson basically shrugged off the dune. And so the Stars put Oleksiak in just because for a little bit of the size, a little bit of he was Fedun had been the only defenseman that had kind of pushed around a little bit. But as far as Oleksiak's overall play, I think he's come back and he's played well and he's played in a role he probably should have been played in. So Jamie Oleksiak to me has always been miscast because you look at him at 6'7" and you think he's going to be like Zdeno Chara, and he's not Zdeno Chara. He likes to move with the puck a little bit more. He likes to jump into the play more. And while he's big and could be more physical, he's not as physical as his size really would indicate. If he was 5'10" and he played his game, you'd say that's a pretty good third pairing defenseman. And so I think the time he's come back to Dallas, he's been put in a role that fits him better. The expectations are better as he's a third pairing guy. And I think with that understanding from now the player's never going to say, "Oh, I'm a third pairing guy." Everyone's going to say they're better than they really are. But I think with that expectation in coming back from the trade, I think it's fit better for him. And he's played very well, I thought, in the final four games of that series against Nashville.
You know, Sean, Ben Bishop makes 47 saves in the Game 6 win and, you know, had a stellar performance. He only seems to be gaining traction as the playoffs go along. But, I mean, should backup goalie Anton Khudobin also get a W in his record for telling John Klingberg where to shoot in that overtime for the game winner and the series winning goal?
Yeah, I actually give... Anton Khudobin is always chatting on the bench. Anton Khudobin is telling guys everything, and so... I'm not sure how often guys actually listen to him because, A, he's not the easiest person to understand, and he's always chatting. So credit to John Klingberg for actually listening to what the goalie had to say and telling him, seeing that spot on Rene. So, yeah, give Khudobin, I guess, like the I don't know what's the – not the save because whatever – I'm sure there's some baseball equivalent we could apply to it here, right?
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt, Sean. Last question for you, and we appreciate you're giving us your time as you're on your way to St. Louis for the Stars and the Blues series. You know, when I was watching Game 6 of this series, the one player who stood out to me almost shift in and shift out was Blake Como, and now he's playing, of course, on the line with Andrew Cogliano.
Good Saskatchewan boy.
Yeah, who they acquired from the Anaheim Ducks earlier in the year, and Radek Faksa, sort of the younger of the three players on that line. How important has that line been for the Dallas Stars, especially in the first round? I thought Blake Como played. It looked like he was sort of hooked up to the fountain of youth, a guy who's, you know, 33 years old, certainly a veteran. I thought he played a really impressive, certainly Game 6 against the Predators.
Well, think about it this way. He's a 13-year career. He won his first ever playoff series. So that was something that was big. I talked to him the other day about it. That's something that, talk about getting the monkey off your bat. He'd been to the playoffs, but he had never won a series before that. So that was something that he was quite pleased with. And yeah, Cogliano and Fox really did a great job at the series in just eliminating the Johansson, Forsberg, Arvidsson line, just kind of taking them out of the play and making them obsolete. And Como, one thing that he did in Game 6, I thought he was going to be one to score the overtime winner because he was just buzzing the entire time. He's a huge part of the Stars' penalty kill, which is really built on the forecheck and the pressure, and it's worked, and he's kind of stepped into that leadership group for the Stars, where you may remember after all the Jim Light's comments midpoint of the season where they talked about a culture of mediocrity. Well, I give guys like Como and Cogliano and some of the other older guys credit for kind of flipping that culture around and really taking hold and being that support group for the captaincy and Jamie Benn and Tyler Seguin. And he's been really important to the group to that team, and he's been, now that he's kind of been put on that third line role and killing penalties, it's a really good spot for him and a good fit.
Sean Shapiro covers the Dallas Stars for TheAthletic.com. He's on his way to St. Louis to cover the second round between the Stars and the Blues. Sean, appreciate your time. Travel safe. Enjoy the second round between these two teams.
Yep, thanks. You guys have a good one.
Take care, Sean. Thanks again. When we come back, we talk about the Game 7 last night between the Bruins and the Leafs. The Leafs are going home. The Bruins are on to the second round, and they would be ostensibly the Stanley Cup favorite as the highest-ranked team left in the Stanley Cup playoffs. You're listening to NHL This Week. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the O'Legal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
On TSN1290.ca.
Krejci takes it away. Krejci to Coyle. And the Leafs.
The Bruins score three in the third. The Leafs score none. Matthews played less than 19 minutes, his second fewest of the series. So it is more Game 7 heartbreak for the Leafs.
I don't think enough people are making note of the fact that Jack Edwards, in his final call in that series, said, "The Leafs are mulch again." I mean, that's genius. I want my call, I want my phone to ring with "The Leafs are mulch again." I mean, as long as you're not a Leafs fan, that's funny. And that's, Jack is a good friend of this program. So, I like Jack a lot.
He's that one of the best play-by-play guys in the game.
Yeah, I mean, he's a total homer, but Jack would tell you that he's a total homer. The fact he says the Leafs are mulch again as the Bruins win the series and win Game 7 is absolutely fantastic. Welcome back to NHL This Week, Wednesday evening. We are live here on TSN Radio 1290. This segment of the show is brought to you by our good friends at Bernstein's Deli, official deli of Illegal Curve Hockey and home of the Illegal Curve sandwich. Bernstein's is proudly family owned and operated and has been serving quality home style food since 1985. For a hot, fresh breakfast starting at 6:30 in the morning, weekdays and all day long, weekdays and weekends, visit Bernstein's Deli at 1700 Cordon Avenue. That's in the Cordon Village Mall.
Like, I realize we're in Winnipeg and we're the home of the Jets, but why are there still so many people that receives so much joy when the Leafs are eliminated from the playoffs? It's unbelievable. Every year, well, you see this, on social media.
You hear about them nonstop. So when you don't want to hear about them anymore, when they finally lose, you take, take pleasure in their pain because you've been you've had to hear about the Leafs for 6 months. You don't care about the Leafs, but it's the only thing that a lot of certainly the national media will speak of. I mean, we don't speak about it to that extent because it's a, Jets town here. But when all, the national media will talk about, and the Athletic has 48 people covering the Leafs-Bruins series.
Shout out to Jonas Siegel.
Well, they literally, I think, had 312 credentials for the, for that game 7. It was ridiculous. So of course you're happy when the Leafs lose because it makes you feel better about yourself. Really? You're not? I was cheering for the Bruins.
I picked the Leafs in the series. I'm not a Leafs fan.
Well, okay. Well, you picked wrong.
Well, I did. And by the way, I'm 1-for-7.
Congratulations.
Well, if Washington wins, Drew, I'm going to go 2-for-8.
Yeah, but that's why you're on the radio as a hockey genius right there.
Yeah, and I'm also the guy that picked the Oilers to win the Cup a couple of years ago.
And
but
Todd Richards to get the Jack Adams Trophy a week before he was fired.
Guys, if the Sharks would have lost that game, I would have been 0-for-7.
Yeah.
So that Sharks game really,
feather in your cap there, young man.
Gave me at least one win.
Yeah, congratulations. One series win there. Let's talk about game 7. I mean, Mike Babcock's decision-making is inexplicable. You're down 3-1.
Well, why didn't he put William Nylander with Austin Matthews? I don't get it. I mean, William Nylander was good in game 1.
Yeah.
And, he just wasn't really a factor for much of the series.
Well, he gave away, his play there that ends up in the empty net goal that makes it 4-1.
He tries to make the move at the blue line and...
What are you doing in that situation? There's no goalie behind you. You can't give the puck away.
Thoughtless hockey.
I mean, Nylander looked awful in last night's game.
Well, the first goal that Nordstrom scored, Joachim Nordstrom, and he was a healthy scratch earlier in the series. But, you talk about coaching decisions.
Yeah.
I mean, Carson Kuhlman, good friend of the show, former University of Minnesota Duluth Bulldog. Yeah. He was a healthy scratch for two of the 7 games. He comes back and, he was a factor in game 7. But, you talk about, David Backes, and I'm forgetting who else was a healthy scratch there. The other Bruin, remind me who it is.
Keep going. I'll think about it. Keep making your point.
David Backes was one guy who got into either one or two games of the 7-game series, and then he was a healthy scratch for the last, three games.
Well, Marcus Johansson was in and out because he was injured. I forget. It doesn't matter. Go on.
Who was the other guy on the fourth line?
There's Sean Corrali.
Sean Corrali scored. Yeah, he was in the game, but
there's Noel Acciari.
No.
Matt Grizzlick.
No, he's a defenseman. Yeah. No. Anyways, I mean, the decisions that Bruce Cassidy made, they really paid off. And when you talk about, the matchups and all that, we talked about, the goaltending being huge. Freddie Anderson was better than Tuukka Rask in the series. Maybe not game seven, but overall he was better.
Yeah.
And, we talked about the big line, but Bruce Cassidy actually had to take David Pastrnak off of the top line and move him to the second line. And, David Krejci was very good in this series as well. He's had a fantastic career, especially in the playoffs. You think about 2011 when they won the cup, he's always stepped up in the playoffs. But I agree with you. Mike Babcock just didn't seem to really have the right moves to make, or he didn't make the right moves, I should say, after Nazem Kadri was out and suspended for game 3-7.
Never mind that. In game 7, you're down 3-1. There's no tomorrow.
Yeah, do something.
You need Austin Matthews out on the ice every second shift for the last 10 minutes of that game.
And he was by far the Leafs' best player. I mean, I realize, again, going back to what we were talking about with the Jets and the Blues, I mean, Mitch Marner scores two goals in game one, and then he doesn't score another goal for the rest of the series. And then for games four, five, and six, he had one combined shot. So, I mean, Mitch Marner just wasn't a big factor, and that's your top scorer. That's a 94-point guy there. And I think the Bruins, and specifically the pairing of Zdeno Chara and Charlie McAvoy,
did a great job.
They just absolutely neutralized him.
Yeah, they did a fantastic job. I mean, but to be in the latter stages of that game last night, and you're still throwing out, you know, Freddie Gauthier.
Who Babcock loves.
I don't care.
Doesn't matter.
He doesn't score.
Just saying.
He's talking about the GOAT there, Drew.
I know you're talking about the GOAT, but I'm not talking about the greatest of all time. I'm talking about a guy whose nickname is the GOAT.
GA.
Yeah. You know, you can't. Every time Freddie Gauthier jumps over the bench in the last 10 minutes of that game, if you're the Boston Bruins, you have to say, okay, thank you very much. We know you're not going to score on this shift, and we're one shift closer to this game being over. And then
Wagner was the guy I was thinking about. Chris Wagner. He was a healthy scratch for game seven.
And then you saw, you know, Patrick Marleau, and they asked, you know, Babcock in the post-game scrum why Patrick Marleau was out on the ice in late stages of the game. And Patrick Marleau has had a fantastic NHL career, but he's absolutely running on fumes, and that's probably the nicest way I can say that. The fact that it's not Austin Matthews, Mitch Marner, John Tavares, and then William Nylander, and they're not trying to clone those guys on the bench in order to get them back out on the ice quick enough, is a failure of coaching, no questions asked. I mean, it's adding a degree of difficulty to trying to come back and win a game seven that doesn't need to be there. It's not rocket science at a point in time. You're down in the game. You're down. Your series is almost over. Play your best players. It's not difficult.
At the end of the day, guys, the Leafs were winning this series 3-2.
On home ice.
For the most part. I mean, Patrice Bergeron absolutely dominated John Tavares. I mean, when you talk about in the faceoff circle, I mean, we know Bergeron's a 60% faceoff guy. I think he was even above 60% overall in the faceoff circle, oftentimes going up against Tavares. But, I mean, it's not like Brad Marchand was the difference in the series. I mean, he was good. I mean, he scored some goals,
there was none of the sideshow involving Brad Marchand.
But I guess the point I'm trying to make, I mean, Marchand did have 9 points in seven games, but I guess
It
was a quiet 9 points, and I think for the most part, I mean, Jake Muzzin and Nikita Zaitsev, that pair, I actually think for the most part, when they were up against the Bergeron line, they did a pretty decent job. And when you're talking about Austin Matthews, I mean, he only had one goal in last year's playoffs. I mean, this year he was clearly their best player, and that's what you would expect out of
then
Matthews.
Why isn't he on the ice for the last 10 minutes of the game nonstop?
Well, and also special teams. I mean, Boston's power play, what were they at, 40%?
Something like that.
I mean, Toronto's power play was terrible.
Yeah.
And Boston's was fantastic. But at the end of the day, I mean, it was a game seven, guys. And the Leafs, again, were a no-show in game seven.
Well, there's so much pressure on Toronto in these situations, right? Going into game seven, playing Boston, you know.
There's no more pressure on Toronto than there is Boston.
I don't know about that.
Okay. I'm just saying that the
pressure compounded.
Back-to-back game sevens.
But that you talked about that Joachim Nordstrom goal, the first one, it kind of squeaks under
Anderson
the arm.
Anderson has to have
Anderson,
that, Shawnee.
And you can just kind of see the Leafs not implode, but you see the pressure gain on them a little, and then it's 2-0 off that Jake Gardner turnover, and Marcus Johansson scores, and then the pressure is on Toronto, and they make it 2-1, and you're thinking to yourself, okay, like, maybe they can rally, maybe the granite stone will be set for the Toronto, and then that Sean Corrali coasts through the neutral zone. He avoids a couple pretty weak stick checks. Snipes home the 3-1 goal, and
is that shot tipped? Because it looked to me like Morgan Riley's stick
didn't actually hit the puck.
Yeah, I don't think it actually hit the puck. But Don Cherry talked about a few goals that have happened this playoffs with stick on stick, and how the goalies can't read the follow through. I don't know. Regardless, some pretty poor defensive play through the neutral zone, and the 3-1 goal that just crippled Toronto, I thought.
And Shawnee, you mentioned, you know, the Bruins' first two goals, the Nordstrom goal, and then the Marcus Johansson goal. When you were watching that game last night, did that not remind you of last year's Jets Predators series when Tyler Myers and Paul Stastny scored those first goals on Pekka Rinne
from behind the line?
You knew the game was over after that.
Yeah. Another failure for the Toronto Maple Leafs. Back to the drawing board for a team that certainly will be up against the salary cap and trying to fit everyone under in the offseason where a lot of players will need new contracts. When we come back, we're joined by Ty Anderson. Ty covers the Boston Bruins for 98.5, the sports hub in Boston. They're off to the second round against the Columbus Blue Jackets. We talk to Ty up next. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.
Hour number two of NHL This Week starts now on TSN Radio 1290. Drew Mandel, Ezra Ginsberg, Sean Assor with you in studio. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. You can reach us in studio via text message. Send your text to 129090. Standard messaging rates do apply. And of course, our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news and audio is illegalcurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
From 98.5, the Sports Hub in Boston, we're pleased to welcome to the program Ty Anderson. Ty covers the Boston Bruins. Ty, good evening and thanks for joining us.
No worries, guys. Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. Ty, obviously brought you on to talk about the Bruins, and we will look ahead to the second round matchup against the Columbus Blue Jackets. But first, we have to look back to last night, Game 7 between the Bruins and the Leafs, and a little bit of deja vu for the Boston Bruins as they handle the Leafs on home ice relatively easily. You know, what did you think of the Bruins' performance, I guess, in the entirety of the series? It goes 7 games. You know, they were really right up against it, down 3-2 going to Toronto, yet they were yet again able to pull it out over what to me looked like a somewhat overmatched Leafs team when the going got tough in the last couple games.
Yeah, definitely. I think if you look at this series in a vacuum, the Leafs outplayed the Bruins for large chunks of the series and in particular in Toronto, but they just simply couldn't find that extra goal or the game-tying strike or the put-away goal to put the Bruins away. And I think that really kind of helped the Bruins get some confidence as they went on in this series. You look at some of the younger players, and they struggled out of the gate. Brandon Carlo didn't look great off the jump. David Pastrnak kind of reverted back to what he was 2 years ago. But as the series went on, Jake DeBrusk, another one, got more comfortable as the games continued and got more intense. And gee, you know, you feel bad for Jake Gardner. It really seems like his game sevens are just cursed at this point, right? He's a -3 last night. He was a -5 last year. It's just a horrible time for the Maple Leafs to really choke. And I think, you know, this was their own fault, really. They let the Bruins hang around. And that's a Bruins team with a ton of experience, a ton of veteran know-how, and guys that know how to calm a room down between Bergeron and Chara. So when the going got tough, I really thought the Bruins stayed comfortable and the Leafs really tightened up, I thought, offensively.
You know, Ty, you just referenced plus-minus there, and that really leads nicely into my question, because I wanted to ask you about the elder statesman on the Bruins, Zdeno Chara, and he led all Bruins with a +6, and, you know, Brad Marchand, Patrice Bergeron, David Pastrnak, I mean, these are the Bruins' top players, and, you know, they were really good in this series versus the Leafs. But, you know, I was watching Zdeno Chara all series long, the games, of course, in which I watched, and, you know, it almost was shades of 2011 Zdeno Chara. And, you know, I just wanted to ask you about that pairing of Charlie McAvoy and Chara, because, you know, as far as I'm concerned, they did an excellent job for the majority of the series shutting down the Leafs' top line.
Yeah, definitely. I thought there were games where they sort of split the duties as to who was the true number one and who was the number two. And I thought that McAvoy had a great game 7. I thought Chara, you know, there were times where he looked uncomfortable, like going against Marner or going against Tavares. But as the series went on, he just relied on his stick presence and knowing how to use his body and the things he can get away with. Obviously, he takes some liberties when he can, but it's a part of what makes him such an effective and, you know, intimidating defenseman to play against. And I really thought that this was a bad series for Chara from a matchup standpoint. But the fact that he adjusted and adapted and found ways to limit Marner and Tavares, I mean, keep in mind, I thought Marner and Tavares were probably the Leafs' two best players for the first two games in the series. And then they were just quiet. They went out without a fight. And I really thought that Chara and McAvoy had a big part to do with that, given the way that they were playing. I thought McAvoy, you watched last night's game, man, and he was just flying all over the place, end to end. He was the first guy back, but while also leading the rush. just an absolute performance that really sort of makes you believe that this guy might be the heir apparent to Chara, who, like you mentioned, is still going at 42 years old.
You know, Ty, I got to ask you, it's pretty awesome when Bruins head coach Bruce Cassidy comes to the podium and talks about how he, the crowd, and the team itself found a source of inspiration and motivation to see Julian Edelman chugging a beer in the press box.
Yeah, I mean, that was wild. You know what's great about Boston, and this has happened because all these teams now in Boston are contending for titles or making deep playoff runs. It really is like a brotherhood now. You see Bruins players at Red Sox games. You see Red Sox players at Bruins games, Patriots, Celtics, you name it. They're all there. They all support one another. And I think that's something that I think the teams in town have really kind of latched onto. The whole Celtics team was at the game last night. The Patriots had their own box, and there were countless players from their team there. You know, I've seen Red Sox players at games earlier this postseason when they didn't have schedule conflicts. So it does. It is unusual, I guess, that you have a city that the four teams rally around one another. But it's a real thing in Boston, and I just think it speaks to the era that they're all living in, and they all understand how cool it is to have four teams that are competitive and competing for titles. But yeah, I mean, I couldn't believe that last night, seeing him chugging a beer in the Jumbotron. I didn't know who it was at first, and then I went, oh my goodness, that's Julian Edelman. That's the Super Bowl MVP right there. So it got everyone fired up, and it got Bruce Cassidy fired up too, as you mentioned.
Ty Anderson is our guest on NHL This Week. Ty covers the Boston Bruins for 98.5, thesportshub.com. The Bruins into the second round, of course, to face the Columbus Blue Jackets. Let's talk about that matchup. The Blue Jackets obviously haven't played in, it seems like, about 3 weeks, having defeated the Tampa Bay Lightning in four games straight, as we all expected. The Bruins, you know, they're the top remaining team left in the Stanley Cup playoffs based on regular season performance. How do you think they match up against the Blue Jackets? So how do you think the sort of this series is going to shake out between the Bruins and the upstart Blue Jackets?
Well, I think it's a better matchup for Boston than Toronto, as weird as that may sound. I think that Columbus plays a style of play that the Bruins are comfortable playing. It's not going to be run and gun. It's going to be tight, physical, you know, shop-locking kind of parade games. And I think that helps the Bruins as much as does the Blue Jackets. And listen, the layoff factor is real here. It's been, what, 9 days since the Blue Jackets played a game, and the Bruins played 2 days ago. And you can say, okay, well, the Bruins are tired, but that momentum may help them out of the gate here. You know, it might not be until this series hits back to Columbus that the Blue Jackets finally feel as if, okay, we got our legs back now, and let's see what we can do. So I like this matchup for the Bruins. I think these teams are very similar with how they're built, with high-end skill, but also, you know, some gritty kind of forwards and wingers that you go down the roster. I think the big matchup here is Josh Anderson against the Bruins defense. That's a difficult matchup for them. You look at their back end there, they have Torrey Krug and Matt Grizzly, two guys that are 5'9". And then you have John Moore, who's not really the most physical defender. So you're going to have to see how that plays out, because Josh Anderson, as we've seen, can be a game changer. And so I think that's worth watching. But one stat I wouldn't sleep on here is that Bobrovsky hasn't really played well against the Bruins in his career. They were actually the last team that he defeated in the NHL. And keep in mind, he was playing for the Flyers and the Blue Jackets, so he got plenty of cracks at Boston. And he never really defeated them until a few years ago. So I don't know. If they can get on him early, maybe this is they revert back to the Jackets of old. But you can't sleep on this matchup. I think it's going to go 6 or 7. But I think ultimately home ice should benefit the Bruins here.
You know, Ty, you just mentioned not sleeping on the matchup, and you mentioned Josh Anderson, who's obviously a big power forward for the Blue Jackets, and the Bruins have their own big power forward themselves, and that's Sean Corrali, and he obviously scored, you know, the big third goal for the Bruins, which was the insurance goal. But, you know, this is a guy that I've always liked. He was a late pick of the Sharks, and he's coming off of the career year. But is this a coming out party for Corrali? Because I'm sure in Boston, you know, the fans appreciate how good of a hockey player he is. But do you think, you know, he's getting enough recognition for how good of a player he is? And he kind of exemplifies the, you know, the identity of the Bruins.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I think a lot of people, when he was injured for a month, they didn't realize how important he was. And Cassidy was the first person who said it. He said, listen, he's a guy, he drives our fourth line. He's the sled dog of that line, Cassidy said. And I love that quote because it's so true. You watch the fourth line and how they struggled out of the gate against Toronto. And then you see when he comes back, it's like a totally new line. So they rely on him for a lot of things. And one of the most important things is that he's their only left-handed faceoff option. They don't have any other forwards they like putting there that's a left-handed face-off man. So he's very important to this team. He is a motor type of player. you know, he gets the energy going for that team on a nightly basis. And one of the things that they use with Corrali is they really put him out there against the other team's top line. They're comfortable doing that. And that really takes the pressure off Patrice Bergeron. It takes the pressure off David Krejci. I think those players are freed up when Corrali is doing his thing. So he's a huge, hugely important piece of the puzzle for them. And if you go back to 2017 and even last year, he scored some big goals for them. You know, he scored a double OT goal in Ottawa 2 years ago. He scored against the Leafs last year as well. And last night he gets the insurance goal. So he has a knack for these big moments in these situations. And I think now people are starting to realize how important he can really be to this team.
You know, Ty, just kind of thinking about Zdeno Chara, I know you talked about him a little bit earlier in the segment, but you know, if you look at his social media, you listen to his interviews, he's a guy who is such a classy guy off the ice. I mean, he's well-spoken. He takes the time to interact with fans on the street, after games, regardless, you name it. But, I mean, this is also a guy that has a bit of a mean streak to him, and we kind of saw that at the conclusion of the second period yesterday. I mean, that little sucker punch to John Tavares, I mean, he's kind of playing with fire in a 2-1 game going into the third period. He could have easily taken a penalty to give Toronto a power play, but I mean that was a sneaky little sucker punch.
Oh, it absolutely was, and I was amazed he didn't get a penalty for it or a fine of some sort. I mean, that was pretty blatant, and you know, I think it really comes back to their strategy from the get-go. Really seemed to be I've used the term, they were trying to beat the compete out of John Tavares and Mitch Marner and Austin Matthews. They thought maybe they could bully them like they bullied the Sedins back in 2011, or you know, they tried it with the Blackhawks in 2013, didn't work out. So maybe they were trying to do something like that. But yeah, that was a dirty one. And you go back to the game before that, he leaves his feet to hit Jake Muzzin. Dude, you're 6'9". You don't got to do that. Like, you're a big guy. You don't have to do that. So yeah, he does toe the line. And I think, you know, I think in a game 7 elimination game, he is a tone setter. I mean, keep in mind, this team, they've always had that image. They've always been the big bad Bruins. And right now, you know, they've moved away from that a little bit. So I think, you know, he tries to bring that back when necessary. But he is walking a fine line, because I'll tell you what, they're going to be watching for that in this series, especially given some of the Blue Jackets' more feisty players with Brandon Dubinsky, Josh Anderson, Nick Foligno, you name it. So that's going to be worth watching to see if he indeed crosses the line again in this series.
Yeah, it's going to be a black and blue series between the Bruins and the Blue Jackets. Looking forward to it beginning now that the Bruins are into the second round, having defeated the Toronto Maple Leafs. Ty Anderson covers the Bruins for 98.5, the Sports Hub. Ty, appreciate your time this evening. Thanks for joining us. Enjoy the second round.
Anytime, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Ty. Take care. When we come back, we discuss the controversial ending to Game 7 between the Sharks and the Golden Knights. The Sharks are off to the second round, and to say that the Golden Knights are mad would be an understatement. You're listening to NHL This Week. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the O'Legal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
On TSN1290.ca.
They said basically cross-check him across the face, and we all seen that didn't happen. You know what? Last year we were in the Stanley Cup Finals and it was tough to lose. Tonight was tougher than that. It really was, the way we lost that hockey game. I mean, like I said, I'm sure you've all seen it on TV. There was no intent. I feel awful that Joe got hurt. You know, he's a class player for their team. You know, everybody loves him. But there was no intent. There was no high stick that hit him in the face. It was an awful call. We all seen it. And it's too bad that, you know, we end up losing because of that, because we were in control of the hockey game.
There's Vegas Golden Knights head coach Gerard Gallant. It was an awful call. 5-minute major handed out to Cody Eakin, a game misconduct. The Golden Knights were leading 3-0 at that point in time. 4 power play goals later, the Sharks led 4-3. The Golden Knights tied it up. Jonathan Marchessault, who we'll hear from momentarily, tied it at 4 until the San Jose Sharks won late in the first overtime. They win the series 4-3. They were down 3-1 and then rattled off 3 victories in a row. Let's start with the bogus penalty call. That's about as bad a penalty call as you're going to see in the NHL playoffs.
I just feel bad for anybody that was watching that game and then when it was 3-0 decided to go to bed.
You mean like me? Yeah, I mean, I went to bed.
I mean, the best part is, you admittedly, know, for those who follow us on Twitter, we do the ICOT pool, right? And just before that, David
brought
tweeted,
to you by Rumors Restaurant and Comedy.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And, you know, obviously, you know, in the third period with 11 minutes left, when the Golden Knights went up 3-0, you thought, okay, this game's over.
Well, and,
the series is over.
Dave tends to stay up later than I do, so it's 3-0. The series is over. I'm going to go to bed.
It's about 10 o'clock.
Yeah, that's clever. It was like 11. Thank you. I said to Dave, okay, I'm going to bed. If, you know, if something wacky happens, you know, you can run the pool. He's usually up later than I am.
Yep.
Did not expect to wake up this morning and
does
find
Dave
out.
Does Dave sleep, by the way?
I don't
like,
think so.
I feel like he sleeps like maybe 2 hours a night.
I think he might sleep upside down like a bat.
Yeah.
I was going to say, maybe he's a vampire.
It could very well be the case. Yeah. And then waking up this morning, I did not expect to see a 5-4 overtime final for the San Jose Sharks. And then to see how it unfolded with four power play goals on that 5-minute major. I mean, that was an epic game. It was a terrible call. It had basically everything you'd want rolled up into one dramatic third period.
Before we get to, you know, the what everybody's talking about, Cody Eakin's 5-minute major, I mean, when you're talking about the all-time great finishes in a first round, you know, game seven, I mean, that has to be right up there with one of the best finishes of all time. And I don't care if you're a Sharks fan or a Golden Knights fan or a Jets fan or whatever. When you're down 3-0, and then you're able to score four goals. And then obviously, you know, the game goes to overtime after Jonathan Marchessault ties it up with, you know, less than a minute left. But, I mean, you know, we've been talking about it all day here on TSN 1290. I mean, I think we all agree that that should have been a cross-checking minor, not a 5-minute major. And, you know, by the way, I mean, Ken Campbell's a great writer for the Hockey News, but what is he talking about as far as Paul Stastny deserving a suspension? I mean, Paul Stastny, to me, is just, I mean, that's incidental contact. I mean, Ken Campbell, if you haven't, you know, read this.
I haven't. I missed this article.
Ken Campbell is saying that, you know, what Paul Stastny did slamming Joe Pavelski down to the ice was actually worse than the Eakin crosscheck. I mean, like, what play was he watching? I mean, as far as, if you weren't watching it or you haven't seen the highlight, Stastny is just trying to go to the point and, you know, Pavelski's crosschecked and he just happens to kind of, you know, get in his way a little bit. Stastny was not doing anything malicious there.
It's not like he hits his head on the ice square. It's his helmet that cuts him. He hits the ice. He's wearing his full helmet. The helmet obviously hits the ice, and that's what cuts Pavelski and makes it. I mean, it's not that it's worse than it looked. It was bad, and he was obviously woozy, and he was injured. But the referees in this instance, no doubt whatsoever, they called the result, the unfortunate result, and handed out the major, not because of the infraction, because the infraction, like you said, was at worst a 2-minute cross-checking penalty, and it's the kind of thing that you probably have seen, you know, go uncalled more than once. It's just a bad result, and a really bad result for the Vegas Golden Knights.
Yeah, that's the worst part about it, is that, you know, as hockey fans, we see worse plays like that go uncalled probably 7-8 times a period, especially in the playoffs, and you know, you talk about the hectic nature of a face-off and just the scramble mentality to it, and there's a lot of moving parts and a lot of things happening. So I'm not giving the referee the benefit of the doubt here, but you can understand how he maybe misconstrued the call. However, now the discussion is whether or not NHL officiating needs to take a step back and include video replay in these kind of situations. To me, it's almost reminiscent of, was it the makeshift referees in the NFL, the Green Bay Packers? Was it Seattle?
Seattle,
no touchdown, touchdown.
The fail Mary is what it's called, where the officials couldn't decide on what the penalty was. Let's hear from Jonathan Marchessault. He was certainly heated post-game. Ezzy, you're already rolling your eyes, so I'll get your opinion on Jonathan Marchessault's comments post-game. This is the Golden Knights forward.
I mean, I really hope that Joe Pavelski is okay. Obviously, you never want to see something bad like that happen, but it's a f***ing joke. Call 5 minutes for that? That's, why don't you have a hockey replay or something? Change the whole outcome of the game. Like, seriously, what is that? It's so disappointing. It's like trying to get involved in the game. The game's not even close. It's 3-0. Call the 2, okay, but a 5 with something you don't even see? You just call the outcome. Joke, it's embarrassing. That call, like, changes the whole outcome, changes the whole future of us, the outcome of this year, and it's a joke. I mean, I would be embarrassed if I was them.
That's Jonathan Marchessault of the Vegas Golden Knights. He more or less blames the officials for the Vegas Golden Knights loss, in you know, that the Sharks had the opportunity to get the four power play goals in a 5-minute major, which is pretty hard to do, I'll point out.
Yeah, Drew, and it's understandable why Marchessault is ticked off, especially considering that he was the guy that tied the game up and sent it to overtime, right? But I mean, at the end of the day, the Golden Knights penalty kill allowed four goals.
Yeah.
On one penalty. I mean, and you know, when you're talking about Kevin LeBanc, he had a point on every single goal, right? And
goal and three assists on the
he beasted,
right? Yeah. And I think that's the first time anybody's ever done that, yeah, by the way. So when you're talking about, you know, that penalty, obviously it was the turning point in the game. It was 3-0, but you know, Cody Eakin's goal was almost called off, and you could make the argument that that was high sticking.
Depended on that goal
shouldn't have counted. And I don't agree with him. You know, the game was 3-0, and most likely the Golden Knights were going to win that game if there wasn't that 5-minute power play. But, you know, the Sharks actually played pretty well in that game. And I think, you know, it goes back, guys, to, you know, at the end of the day, when you're talking about, you know, that penalty, mm-hmm. and, you know, Sean mentioned the video review. I don't disagree with you, Shawnee, but if you're going to have video review,
for
penalties, I mean, Rick and Huss talked about this. Where do you draw the line, right? Because
every hockey game is going to last 7 hours. They're never going to end, and everything's going to be reviewed.
Right? Can you really review every single penalty?
Can't you just do that? Take the minutes to get the call right, or is it just the discretion versus the?
You know, humans have always been involved in the game. The game is played by humans.
So this is just a byproduct then? Something that
human
has to be dealt with?
Human infallibility. I mean, the
Hockey Robot League is going to be dropping pretty soon.
Well,
Drew,
when the Hockey Robot League starts, then they can use video review. But, you know, it's unfortunate. I think the video review on every offside is patently absurd. You know, it's a bad call. The officials should be disciplined for it. It sucks if you're a Vegas Golden Knights player. But you know what? Don't give up four power play goals. You know, make a save. If you're Gerard Gallant, call a timeout. Break up the momentum. Do something to limit the impact of that 5-minute major. It's not like every 5-minute major results in the team scoring four goals. We've seen plenty of 5-minute majors where a team doesn't get any goals scored on them. So yeah, it sucks, but not everything needs to be rectified by video review all the time. The officials will be disciplined.
Even the blatant ones?
Even the blatant ones, the officials will be disciplined, and they should be docked, and they should be penalized, and they should not work any more playoff games. And hell, if the NHL wants to fire them for screwing it up, by all means, it doesn't bother me. Not everything needs to be video review at all times.
Guys, you know, I realize that, you know, we're talking a lot about, you know, the cross check by Cody Eakin, you know, to Joe Pavelski, and how that really changed game 7 in the whole series. But I think what's maybe being lost here is the way Martin Jones played in the last three games. And I realize he allowed four goals in game 7, but he made some huge saves in overtime.
Yeah.
He made one that I can remember on William Karlsson and another on Jonathan Marchessault. And, you know, you talk about games 5 and 6, he was phenomenal. I mean, the 58 saves in game 6.
Yeah.
I mean, Martin Jones, I mean, I don't even know how he was standing by the end of that overtime.
Vegas.
And he was so bad, Drew.
In the first few games.
You know, the first three or four games of the series.
After game 1. Game 2, 3, and 4, he was terrible.
All of the criticism, you know, people were asking whether, you know, Aaron Dell was going to start game 5 and Pete DeBoer stick with Martin Jones. And Martin Jones, you know, had the horrible regular season. So I think what's being lost a little bit is how well Martin Jones played in the last three games, specifically game 6. And, you know, how he deserves a lot of credit for sticking in there and responding after he had some pretty bad games early in the series.
Vegas had a 3-2 lead and they were going home on home ice and they lost. So you know what? Enough with all the blames and everything else. And I'll tell you what, I'd like to see these two teams play again because that's a hell of a rivalry. Gerard Gallant calling Peter DeBoer a clown and the war of words between the Muffin Man and Evander Kane. The whole nine yards. It was a great playoff series. And it's unfortunate that a bad call ends up meaning so much, but video review is a bridge too far for me. When we come back, Curtis Pashelka is going to join us. He covers the San Jose Sharks for the San Jose Mercury News. They're off to the second round to face the Colorado Avalanche. You're listening to NHL This Week. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the O'Legal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.
Wednesday evening, welcome back to NHL This Week. We are live here on TSN Radio 1290. This segment of the show brought to you by our good friends at Rumors Restaurant. Restaurant and Comedy Club officially declared the funniest place in Winnipeg by Illegal Curve Hockey. For over 30 years, Rumors has been bringing Winnipeg the best in stand-up comedy. To purchase tickets or for a list of performers and showtimes, visit rumorscomedyclub.com. Remember, any time a playoff game goes to overtime, that means it's time for the hashtag ICOT pool, sponsored by Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club. Pick the player that you think is going to score in overtime. If you are correct, you will win a great prize package from our friends at Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
From the San Jose Mercury News, we are pleased to be joined by Curtis Pashelka. Curtis covers the Sharks, who are off to the second round after that epic, dramatic Game 7 victory over the Vegas Golden Knights. Curtis, good evening, and thanks for joining us.
Oh, sure, guys. No problem. How are you guys doing?
Doing very well, Curtis. I think we're a little less heated in the studio than the Golden Knights were, especially Jonathan Marchessault last night after the controversial five-minute major to Cody Eakin for the unfortunate result, the cross-check that occurred to Joe Pavelski. I guess first things first, any update on the health of Joe Pavelski today ahead of the the second-round series, which will get underway very quickly?
No. The Sharks gave themselves a day off today. I mean, well-deserved, obviously, after that pretty grueling long series there. So no updates today. I guess if there's any good news, it was that his teammates had saw him after the game. He didn't have to go to the hospital right afterwards or anything. His teammates saw him after the game and felt he was obviously feeling a little bit better than he was right when he got off the ice there last night. So no update on Joe Pavelski. We'll hope to get one tomorrow morning.
So obviously it's 3-0 for the Vegas Golden Knights before this incident happens and Pavelski goes down with a scary looking injury. Do you think that the officials, it's obviously not the right call given that there was no cross check to the head. It should have been a minor penalty. Is this a case of the officials calling the end result, the ugly end result of Pavelski bleeding on the ice rather than what they actually saw?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. No one really notices it because, that's a play that happens every hockey game. After every face-off, you guy loses a draw. The other guy's going to try to cross-check and get him off the puck or try to disrupt the play in some fashion or another. So, so it was an official situation where the officials maybe were a little bit in a position, maybe a little bit, screened by some other bodies, as they were, as the play was unfolding. So, I think they got together and they kind of figured out, tried to do the best they could. And obviously you see Joe Thornton on the ice, barely moving, obviously bleeding, just a pretty scary scene altogether. And I think the referees tried to do the best they could under the circumstances. Now you're right. I mean, it wasn't a 5-minute penalty. Maybe it could have been a 2. But obviously tough to swallow. And from the official standpoint, kind of just a really tough position to be in, having to call a play like that, given the injury, without really knowing exactly what happened, knowing that something happened, but you don't quite know what happened or exactly what happened. And you're going to have to make a decision one way or another. So that's what I mean. That's kind of what it boiled down to. You obviously understand the Golden Knights' frustration. But at the same time, all he had to do was maybe win a draw at the start of that power play, clear the ice, and maybe just kind of take a little bit of the heat off and go from there. So you can see their frustration, but at the same time, it's like it's still a 3-0 lead at that point. You got to be able to make some plays going forward.
So, Curtis, it's understandable why everybody's talking about the Cody Eakin major penalty and how it should have been a minor penalty, but do you think maybe the focus should really be on how truly remarkable it is that the Sharks scored 4 goals on 1 5-minute major penalty and the fact that Kevin LeBanc had a point on all 4 of those goals?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, you kind of have to really shift gears there and say, well, what was the call? What happened there? And all of a sudden, bang, bang, right after the penalty is called and Eakin's in the box and gets sent off for, with a 10-minute game misconduct, it's the Sharks score right after that. And then Thomas Hertl scores 45, 50 seconds right after that. And Couture ties it up about 2 minutes later. And, and LeBanc scores, and before you know it, you're just like, what the heck happened here for these last four minutes and 1 second? So, that's something that no one's going to forget. I mean, the Sharks fans have been following the team for a long time. They're used to some playoff disappointment, no doubt about it, but that's a sequence that they'll remember for a long time. I think the players involved certainly won't forget either.
And Curtis, just to kind of add to that, to me, the craziest thing about it is the Sharks' confidence in their man advantage should have been at an all-time low, because going into that five-minute major, they were 0-for-4 on the power play. Then they come in, and it looked like almost it was automatic just right off the bat when Logan Couture scores that one, turns to the bench, and yells, "That's one."
Yeah. Yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, it's amazing what one goal can flip the switch for a team and get the confidence going. And you're right. I mean, they had three power play chances in the first period alone. They had two full 2 minute minors or full two minute man advantages within the first 5-6 minutes of the game. Had another short power play about a minute long later in the third period, and just did not look in sync at all. They looked, they were getting some chances, getting some pucks toward the net, but it wasn't a crisp-looking power play where you're getting one chance after another. It was kind of one chance, and they're done. So, Logan Couture scores that first goal. The confidence grows. There's noise in the arena again, and it just didn't seem like Vegas was able to sort of regroup after that. Obviously, a lot of people are talking, too, that maybe Gerard Gallant should have called a timeout after that second power play goal, just to kind of calm the troops down and maybe take a deep breath and maybe just kind of reorganize from there. But obviously, the Sharks were able to continue that momentum, get tied up the game, and eventually go ahead for a short while before the last minute of the game.
Curtis Pashelka is our guest on NHL This Week. Curtis covers the San Jose Sharks for the San Jose Mercury News. Hey, Curtis, looking at this series, I mean, there was the war of words between Ryan Reeves and Evander Kane, and that's okay, that's fine. I mean, players can sometimes get into it with one another. How surprised were you that Gerard Gallant, before Game 7, comes out and calls Pete DeBoer a clown? You don't usually hear coaches going after each other like those two were, especially publicly in a press conference setting.
Yeah, no kidding. And the day before, obviously, Pete DeBoer had was talking a little bit. I actually asked the question. I said, well, it seems like things are dying down, at least from a chatter standpoint. Do you think that kind of works in your team's favor? And he says, I don't know if it works in our team's favor, but there's still some chattering going on. It's actually their coach is doing the most chattering. The players are just playing. And I was really caught off guard by that quote, because it really kind of came out of nowhere. And so obviously the next day, Pete isn't asked about it the following day during after the morning skate at the Sharks. So we all head over to the arena afterward to talk to Gallant about it. And obviously he had something prepared that he wanted to say. And yeah, when the word clown came out of his mouth, I think everybody, there's about 20, 25 reporters.
Manna from heaven.
We were all like, kind of like a mouth agape, like just like what just happened here. So it was, and then needless to say, we all kind of scurried back to our laptops to knock out a quick story. So it was definitely very surprising. Whether or not that was maybe a little bit of gamesmanship between the two coaches, I don't know. There were reports last night that they might have shook hands for just an instant. It certainly wasn't a long congratulations. It was just a quick, how do you do, a quick handshake and be done with it. Some people said they didn't shake hands at all. I was too busy trying to rewrite a story, right before deadline. And it was kind of a crazy situation, maybe very unusual for two coaches to say like that. Pete DeBoer has been in a little bit through this before with John Tortorella, you might remember. I think it was in 2012. He DeBoer and Torts got into it during a playoff series, I think. So whether it was gamesmanship or there's some genuine bad blood there, I don't know. But certainly made some interesting reading the morning of the deciding game.
Curtis, last question for you here, and I want to keep talking about Game 7. We haven't really even talked to you a lot about Barkley Goodrow's game-winning goal, which was just a beautiful goal. But, we haven't talked a lot about the next round, of course, against the Colorado Avalanche. And, you know, you have Nathan MacKinnon and Mikko Rantanen and Gabe Landeskog. There are no shortage of players that are performing at a really high level and putting up big numbers for the Avalanche. I guess the question I have for you is, how do you think that the Sharks match up against the Avalanche, and specifically, what are maybe one or two key matchups that you're looking at in the second round between the Sharks and the Avalanche?
Well, I would say if the Sharks were fully healthy, then they would match up pretty well. But obviously, we don't know about Joe Pavelski right now. Jonas Donskoy is a little bit of a question mark, too. He was scratched yesterday. He took a big hit from McNabb in overtime of Game 6, so we don't really know his status. Obviously, Erik Karlsson's dealing with what he's dealing with, some leg issues and some groin issues going back all the way to January. So some question marks definitely about the Sharks' health and whether or not they would be able to use that depth against, like you said, a Colorado team that's very top-heavy, but obviously very skilled, too, and very fast. And so I would say the key matchup is how the Sharks are going to try to deploy the defensemen against that top line of Colorado. So you're going to see a ton of Mark Edward Vlasic and Brent Burns skating against that top line, especially when the Sharks are at home and have last change. And even on the road, they're going to try to do whatever they can to get that matchup on the ice. But there's no question. I mean, there's going to be up front, it's going to have to be a team effort to try to slow those guys down. You saw what happened against Calgary. That top line didn't really do too much against the Avalanche. And so it's going to be a challenge for the Sharks to kind of stay on their toes and not let that top line sort of dictate the game. And, you know, obviously Grubauer, too, is just having a terrific, terrific playoff so far. Can the Sharks solve him like they eventually solved Marc-Andre Fleury? So very intriguing series. We'll see what happens here. I wouldn't be surprised if this one goes the distance again, and, you know, we're talking about another crazy Game 7 here in a couple of weeks.
Well, if the Sharks and the Avalanche is anywhere near as entertaining as the Sharks and the Golden Knights, the real victors will be hockey fans throughout the world. Curtis Pashelka covers the San Jose Sharks for the San Jose Mercury News. Curtis, appreciate your time and insight this evening. Thanks so much for joining us.
You got it. Thank you.
Take care, Curtis. When we come back, one final series is still to be decided. It's into the third period, and it's all tied up. We bring you the latest on the Capitals and the Hurricanes. You're listening to NHL This Week. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the O'Legal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.
One final segment Wednesday evening. Welcome back to NHL This Week. Want to make note, this is the season finale of NHL This Week. So, of course, the Saturday show, that'll continue unabated. No worries about that. We'll still be with you Saturday morning, 9 a.m. here on TSN Radio 1290. But as the Winnipeg Jets season comes to an end, that means it'll be the end of NHL This Week until the season restarts in October. We'll spend our time with our families. They apparently want to see us after us having been away for the last few months. And, of course, softball season starting up, which is, you know, very serious business as well.
It's good because I really only want to see you once a week, Drew. Like, I really hate seeing you twice a week.
When I realized,
so this is really nice.
When I realized that I now have 40% less Ezra Ginsberg in my life, I was so excited. I can't even begin to tell you how happy
it be
I was.
50% less?
No, because this show, I mean, I see you 5 hours a week between the 3 hours on Saturday and the 2 hours on Wednesday.
Based on hours.
Based on
hours. I was just thinking of two shows.
No, I understand 50%, but yeah. No. I was going even deeper with the math. So 40% less Ezra Ginsberg in my life is all right with me. One final first round series still to be decided. That's going on right now in the U.S. nation's capital. The Capitals led 2-0. The Capitals led 3-1. You cannot kill the Carolina Hurricanes. This bunch of jerks has tied it up. There's under 10 minutes to play. It is 3-3 between the Capitals and the Hurricanes as they are into the nitty-gritty crunch time with which team will go on to face the New York Islanders in the second round of the Stanley Cup playoffs. The Islanders, of course, having swept the Penguins in the first round. So let's talk about some second round predictions really quickly. Let's start with a series that we know of course, to start in the West, Central Division, St. Louis Blues, Dallas Stars. Ezzy, who do you got?
Yeah, I think this is going to be, as I think you would expect, a very close series. And, you know, the Blues obviously, you know, finished a little bit higher than the Stars in the standings, but you know, the way the Stars dispatched the Predators and really controlled the pace of play and the offensive zone time, you know, really impressed me. And you know, I really liked the way the Blues kind of shut the Jets down in that sixth game. We talked about it last hour, but you know, I think goaltending is going to be huge. Ben Bishop has just been rock solid all year long, but Jordan Binnington has been really good in the second half of the regular season and the first round against the Jets. And, you know, if St. Louis is able to shut down that second line, we talked about it, Jason Dickinson, Rupe Hintz, and Matt Zuccarello, I think it's going to be a very close series. This one to me is a toss up. I'm going to go with the St. Louis Blues in six.
Very good. Sean Assor?
I'm going to go Stars in seven. Dallas is coming off a pretty big win over Nashville, and they're very comfortable in a very stifling defensive game, yet they have some of their big guns playing really well right now. They have the backup goal, the backup offense as well, or I should say the secondary offense, so I am going to go Stars in seven.
By the way, I would like to mention on air,
yes,
if you weren't listening earlier.
Your predictions have been terrible?
So far, I'm 1-7,
yeah,
and my only series win was San Jose, so I easily could have been 0-7.
Yeah.
If Washington loses, I took the Caps, I could be 1-8, so
you're a blithering idiot.
Based on my St. Louis Blues second round prediction, I should probably take Dallas because I should just take the opposite of whoever I think is going to win.
I'll tell you what, if you took the Blues in six, somehow that means the Jets are going to win in five against the Stars. Your predictions have been that bad. This scares me, though. I'm going to agree with you. I think the Blues win as well, but I think the Blues actually take it a little bit easier. Blues in five,
really?
Against the Dallas Stars. Yeah,
interesting.
The Blues, I think, are rolling right now. Other Western Conference win. We got to go real quick here, Ezzy. The Sharks and the Avalanche. Who do you have?
Wow.
real quick.
I mean, everything inside of me wants to say San Jose, but we talked to Curtis Peschelka last segment. I mean, Joe Pavelski, I mean, his health is uncertain. I mean, Erik Karlsson is not 100% healthy. I mean, I want to take the Sharks, but the way the Avalanche played in that first round against Calgary, I was really surprised. I picked the Sharks to win the Cup at the beginning of the season, so I don't really like to bet against myself. I'm actually going to take the Avalanche, though.
Okay.
I'm going to take the Avalanche in six.
Sean?
I also have the Avs in six. I think Nathan MacKinnon is playing at a godly level right now, and
true,
he just dispatched the best team in the West pretty much, so I think he's going to keep it rolling, and I got Avs in six.
Sharks in seven for me. Give me your predictions in the Eastern Conference ones. Just give me one-word answers, basically.
I'm going to go Bruins in seven.
Bruins in seven?
I was going to go Bruins in seven.
It's going to be a bloodbath.
It will be a physical series.
I'm
going Bruins in six.
And, of course, we don't know the answer about the Islanders because we don't know their opponent yet. We'll find that out soon enough. That's it for the Wednesday edition, the season finale of NHL This Week. A big thank you to those who joined us earlier on the program. Sean Shapiro of TheAthletic.com, Curtis Peschelka of the San Jose Mercury News, and Ty Anderson of 98.5 The Sports Hub in Boston, in case you missed any of the show. It's available for download on our website, IllegalCurve.com. It's on TSN1290.ca. It's wherever you get your podcasts. Big thanks to our sponsors, Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, Linden Market Dental Center, Bernstein's Deli, and Zappia Group Realty. Support these fine local businesses because they support Illegal Curve Hockey. For Ezra Ginsberg, for Sean Assor, I'm your host, Drew Mandel. Until Saturday at 9 a.m., we say thank you very much for listening to NHL This Week, and you're listening to the home of the Jets, TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.